F. Lee Bailey was the lawyer who set O.J. Simpson free, probably. That murder of Simpson's wife, Nicole, and her friend Ron was 25 years ago this month. And O.J. Simpson, you may have heard, is on social media now telling Twitter, "I've got a little getting even to do." And he then amassed 700,000 followers in 1 week. Among the outraged comments about his being on Twitter at all, comedian Chelsea Handler said, "Let's all take a moment to be happy O.J. Simpson joined Twitter and not Trump's cabinet. It's the little things these days." But what happened a quarter of a century ago was no joke, as Caitlin Cherry explained.
It's been 25 years this month since Simpson was acquitted of the murders of his wife Nicole Brown and her friend Ron Goldman. The Brown and Goldman families later sued him in civil court for wrongful death and were awarded $33.5 million. Most of this remains unpaid. In the murder trial, the so-called trial of the century, Simpson's so-called dream team of defence lawyers managed to sow doubt in the minds of the jury. They suggested Simpson's arrest was racially motivated. F. Lee Bailey, in particular, cross-examined Detective Mark Furman, first on the murder scene and first among the team of detectives to search O.J. Simpson's house. Furman found a bloodied glove at the scene of the crime and its matching twin in the grounds of Simpson's house. Bailey's famous cross-examination of Furman was key to the acquittal. Bailey undermined the detective's credibility by establishing he'd regularly used racist language against African Americans. That led to the even more famous courtroom scene where O.J. Simpson tried on the gloves, which were clearly too small for his hands. The jury was told, if the gloves don't fit, you must acquit. They did acquit, though it's been claimed since that Simpson stopped taking his arthritis medication in order to cause his hands to swell. DNA testing on the gloves, which linked Simpson to the crime, was claimed to be contaminated and inconclusive.
O.J. Simpson was released from prison in 2017 after spending the best part of 10 years inside for a completely different crime, a botched robbery in Las Vegas. F. Lee Bailey is 86 now. He was disbarred as a lawyer in a couple of states after withholding assets from a case he was involved in. His current partner is a hairdresser, 25 years his junior, and together they started a business with her cutting people's hair while F. Lee Bailey gave them advice. His own career was highly colourful. He dropped out of Harvard, joined the Marines, became a fighter pilot, went back to university and gained the highest marks in the history of Boston Law School. He became one of America's best-known trial lawyers, if not the best-known, working on famous case after famous case. Defending Patty Hearst was one of them. Lee, good morning.
Good morning.
You were probably the most famous criminal lawyer of the second part of the 20th century. What are you doing now, mostly?
Advising criminal lawyers who hope to be icons of the 21st century.
I bet they knock at your door too, do they?
Business is generally brisk.
I know it's a big question, but we've got a bit of time. What was your finest achievement as a lawyer, do you think, or from all those famous trials and cases? When you think back, what are you proudest of?
It's a difficult choice because there are several, but like apples and oranges, they don't bear comparison. I would say over the span of years that the best achievement was the extrication from prison of Dr. Sam Shepard, known in your country as the fugitive from TV and movie explications, but he had lost 11 appeals, and I indeed lost a 12th one. And then I got upset and as a Marine decided I was going to get him out. And I did, after a lot of work, and then had a retrial, and he was summarily acquitted. And the case ended unhappily because he died prematurely, probably of alcohol and drugs. But Sam Shepard had done 10 years for a crime he didn't commit. And there's no way in the world to mix that into the stream of life as we teach it and justify it. Indeed, every day we see people popping out of prison who've done 15, 20, 25 years for crimes where our justice system made a mistake.
That was a significant victory of yours. And as you say, the film The Fugitive with Harrison Ford was loosely based on Shepard's case. From memory, again, there was no one-armed man in real life, was there, for him?
That was a strictly a metaphor for the bushy-headed man that he confronted down on the beach and who conducted the killing without much question, and who was the mayor of that township who lived two doors away.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And so is yours. You lived a very glamorous lifestyle at the peak of your career. You owned a mansion, I think, and cars and aircraft even. But you were later disbarred in a couple of states and declared bankrupt, and your main asset was a car worth less than $2,000. That story is worth telling. When did it start going wrong for you?
Well, it didn't start going wrong. If you embark in the United States, quite apart from New Zealand, Australia, Canada, England, and other places that have a more refined system of justice, if you embark on the United States on a career to kick the government's ass, you can expect them to kick back. And at the end of the day, they have the bigger shoes. However, I will get revenge on everybody by writing my autobiography and naming the good guys and the bad guys. And I hope that you are on the good guy list.
This was to do with these millions of dollars worth of assets of a Frenchman named Claude Duboc, and Justice Department prosecutors used you to assist them in seizing his assets. That's when that started, isn't it?
That was the whole beginning that lit the tail of the rocket and got it moving. And the reason was that the government agreed to give me some shares of stock because they got so much in return. And suddenly the value of the stock skyrocketed, and the government was terribly afraid of the publicity that might result from publication of the fact. It was not known at the time that they had allowed a defense lawyer in a drug case to come up with $40 million in fees, because that's what the stock became worth. And so they decided they wanted to get it back. And like too many instances in my experience, if the United States government wants something for itself, the rule book goes out the window. And that was true in my case. I am still fighting with them. It is pretty much wound down. But I have to warn anyone that wants to go to work for the United States government that they should be prepared to have to worry about whether the coat is strong enough leather or whether somebody will stab them in the back. It's too often a dirty business. Indeed, it's going on today.
That had a grievous effect on your fortunes, and I want to ask you a question. Just as OJ may have had a long sentence slapped on him for that burglary heist in Las Vegas because of the residual feeling that he killed his wife, did you at any time feel that you were being punished for being the lawyer that got him off?
Not at any time, at all times. It was made so plain to me that I'm embarrassed for both my colleagues at the bar and members of the judiciary who had the gall to come up to me after a jury's thumping acquittal, a one-hour deliberation capping a nine-month trial, to come up to me and say, you know, you're a great lawyer, but you perverted your talents in getting that off.
Who said that to you?
Lawyers and judges. At 86, it would do me and my followers little good to name them, but they were lawyers and judges. A very bad example. I was asked by my classmates in law school to give them a talk soon after the verdict to talk about the case. And so I did. They were rude. They were sour. Some walked out, and I have not spoken to one since. I would have expected more honorable men to have applauded a good job of legal work and not to have given an opinion that what they read in the papers disagreed with the result. It was shameful, and it made me decide that had I to do it again, I would go practice law in New Zealand, a much better run country than the one in which I repose.
In fact, you know a bit about New Zealand. Is it correct that your third wife was a New Zealander?
Yes, and Linda Hart Bailey, now Taylor, is also a very good friend, and I talk to her from time to time.
And you've been down to New Zealand, I think.
Yes, I went there several times, but more than that, when I got married to Linda in 1972, I flew her entire family over from New Zealand to attend the wedding. They came to my home in Boston, and then I flew them in a Learjet to Des Moines, Iowa, where we got married.
You certainly reached the heights. Are you reconciled, not happy about, but reconciled to the vicissitudes of your life now?
Well, number one, I really don't have much choice about it.
Yeah.
But to be quite frank, without, I hope, coming off as arrogant, it has been a rough and tumble life. I don't regret any part of it. I particularly celebrate the 4 years I spent in the Marine Corps as a jet pilot, when that was a good way to get killed in a short time. I enjoyed every one of my marriages, none of which were short-termed. And I have won some big cases and had my butt kicked from time to time. And I think it's part of the game. But when I do finally cash in, I think that my bank account of life will be somewhat deeper than those smaller people who have tried to do me in from the flank.
Eloquently put, eloquently put. All right. Do you remain convinced? Of course, OJ has been back on Twitter. And speaking of getting revenge on everybody, which you just said earlier, he's kind of said a mild version of that. He's in the news again, 25 years. Do you remain convinced that he was innocent?
Not only do I remain convinced, to anyone who will take the time to study the case, and that can only be done by looking at the transcript. One cannot trust what the lawyers say. They are advocates. One can certainly not trust what the press say when it came to the evidence. But O.J. could not have committed that crime. I've written a book about it, which I'm taking my time to publish. It's called A Case About a Glove. That's all it was. It should have been over in a couple of weeks. It should have been very apparent in a more honest atmosphere that O.J. would not and could not have committed this crime. And instead, we have created, from my perspective, the most tragic legal screw-up in the history of American jurisprudence. And many children are being brought up today by ignorant parents who will believe, because Daddy said so, oh, he was guilty and Bailey got him off.
Yeah. And that's what they do say.
Well, I've got to tell you something. When the book comes out, we'll separate the wheat from the chaff, the men from the boys, and the other divisions that count in this life. The book is endnoted as opposed to footnoted. Footnotes distract you and make you stop your paragraph and go down to the bottom and find out what the hell the extra information is. Endnotes require you to go to the end of the book if you're that curious about the veracity of the statement you're looking at. And when that book comes out, I'm going to start to take on the people who, with loud mouth and little brain, have said, I know he did it, even though the jury didn't.
On behalf of those people who don't like to work very hard, And I'm not steeped in the case, obviously, but I have done a certain amount of reading. One thing has always occurred to me, and I wonder if you could enlighten us. If the gloves that never quite fitted OJ were a plant by the police, it was decided very quickly. Usually police plant evidence after they cannot get enough evidence on a suspect that they think did it, and that wasn't the case with OJ. The time frame was very short, wasn't it?
Well, it was also highly defective. And here's the problem. The right-hand glove, which certainly had been at the murder scene and did have the blood of the victims, which is all irrelevant if somebody picked it up and transported it to where Furman allegedly found it, and believe me, he did not find it there. If the glove had been handled by OJ and deposited there by OJ, the blood would have dried before it was found. He left California somewhere before midnight, and the glove was found at 5 a.m. It would have dried, and we did experiments to prove this, which the judge did not allow into evidence, like most things that favored the defense. But the blood would have dried in 2 to 3 hours. The glove was wet when it was found, which means that someone picked it up at the murder scene, put it in a plastic bag where it could no longer be exposed to the air and thus dry out, and then taken it from the bag and left it at the murder scene within a short time of when it was found, all of which is in the transcript, and Mr. Furman wound up taking the Fifth Amendment to the question, did you plant the glove? People seem happy to ignore that and to admire Mr. Furman, which does not speak well for America.
I've seen, actually, Mr. Furman on the witness stand saying that the glove was glistening when he found it, so that's interesting. I thought he took the Fifth when you cross-examined him on the racial slurs he had made regarding African-Americans, when you caught him out, I thought he later took the Fifth option so as not to answer that again.
I'm sure that people as astute as yourself also believe that to be the case. That's why I am posting the transcript, because if you look at the separate proceeding never disclosed to the jury, where Furman was called for further cross-examination. I never completed his cross because the tapes came up after I had already cornered him. When he was called for further cross-examination, he was asked several questions. And the final question was, Mr. Furman, he was no longer a detective, Mr. Furman, did you place the glove at O.J. Simpson's house? And he said, I will not answer because it would incriminate me.
Who did kill Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman then?
I think it was a drug killing by mistake intended for Faye Resnick, who had been living at the same condominium until a day or so before and had been committed or voluntarily submitted to an institution to dry out. We think that she owed a bill for cocaine, and a couple of not very bright assassins were told to kill the blonde lady if she didn't pay up, and they got the wrong blonde lady. I mean, it is a tragic comedy in the old Grecian sense, but more tragic than comedy, except that America managed to make a comedy out of the entire tragic event by staging a trial against O.J. Simpson, which really was the retribution of the LAPD for the abuse they properly received in the Rodney King debacle.
Most of those people who haven't done their homework, and you can't blame them, they just know what they read, They invoke Occam's razor. I mean, the explanation that requires the least speculation is usually the best one. They'd had domestic trouble, Simpson had a temper, his alibis changed, he fled down the LA freeway with a passport in his possession. You can understand why most of the world still thinks he got off a murder.
I have to agree with you. I watched that happen. I listened to the reports. I listened to Robert Kardashian read his suicide sounding note on the air while they were looking for OJ. But I listened, and at the very end of that note, it said, "I did not kill my wife." Now, when he became despondent and had his friend drive him to the gravesite where he proposed he would shoot himself, his friend, who had been his friend for many years, said, "OJ, you're not going to do it. You haven't got the guts or the reason. I'll give you 5 minutes, and then we're going home." It was on the way home that someone spotted the Bronco, which was being sought by the police, and the police cars closed in. OJ was in the back seat with a gun, still crying, and Al Cowings, who was driving, got the police on the phone, his cell phone. And he said, "If you close in or pull us over or block our way, he might shoot himself. We're on our way to his home." And he said, "You can follow us there and we'll surrender." And that's exactly what happened. And some idiot, has to be an idiot, said this is a low-speed chase. But that probably, all by itself, myself included to a degree at the time, convinced all the onlookers he wouldn't be running if he didn't do it. And running is perfectly admissible in a murder trial or any other trial to show consciousness of guilt. And then one would ask, as you will find from the transcript, the government, the prosecution, never tried to introduce to the jury any evidence of the Bronco run down to the graveside or back to Rockingham.
Far be it from me to argue with a man of your expertise about any of the details, and I think that would be fruitless. But I have one obvious question. If, as you say, the transcript is on Glove Case 2019 online, if there have been 25 years of people with good legal minds, as well as your own, looking at those transcripts and contemplating, reflecting on that case, why don't more people agree with you?
Because they're not looking at the transcripts. Most lawyers, I'm awfully sad to say, are very quick to shoot their mouths off without doing their homework, particularly when they haven't received a fee to be prepared in the case. The lawyers who assured the world and the parents and the businessmen have never looked at the transcript. And one of the reasons I know that, they all shot their mouths off before I posted it, and they had no access to it.
If you were advising OJ today, what would you say to him about the wisdom of launching a Twitter account in which he says he's got a little getting even to do? Would you tell him just to be quiet?
OJ and I are good friends. I see him from time to time and talk to him from time to time. His judgment is far, far better than he's been given credit for. I knew the moment that I talked to him about the case. I had known him before, but slightly. I knew that he would be a wonderful witness. It's tragic that the prosecution effectively prevented him from testifying. But OJ is 71 years old. He's smart. He's been a winner in business, in athletics. He's been popular until this murder happened. Everybody loved him. I don't have any advice to give him so far about the way he conducts himself. I think it's to be commended. If he wants to Twitter, well, other important people think that that's a way to get the word out. So thank God this is a free, if somewhat discombobulated, country with still far too much bully in its blood. But I think O.J. paid a terrible price for a wrongful conviction in Las Vegas. He has always showed a great deal of equanimity toward the evils that have been heaped on his chest ever since he was a young kid in the slum in San Francisco. And of all the clients that I've had, there's none that I admire more or would more quickly invite into my home than Orenthal James Simpson.
Okay. Speaking of his judgment, though, what did you think about If I Did It, in which he put forth a hypothetical version of the murders as if he had committed them?
I thought it was a disaster. I thought even Rupert Murdoch, who was behind the company that put this whole thing together, didn't know anything about it. It was a promise to pay $3 million to O.J.'s kids that a woman editor conned him into allowing Pablo Fendus, a witness in the case, to spin out a yarn about how O.J. would have done it if he'd done it. It was put to O.J. as evidence that he didn't do it because he would have done it a different way. I cautioned him against it in loud terms, but I am not my brother's keeper. He went ahead with it. Nobody got any money. It absolutely destroyed a lot of public opinion that was favorable to him. And indeed, I had a book that was up for bids at the time, and I withdrew it from the publishing industry because I did not want it to be in the same time frame as that disastrous effort, If I Did It.
So in your view, he was a wronged man. Despite all that you see as evidence to the contrary, are you reconciled to the fact that most people will continue to think, in fact, that justice wasn't done and that he did commit the murder?
Yeah, but who really cares? Because who are they? They don't know what they're talking about. They haven't read the transcript. They weren't present during the trial. And it's wonderful to have opinions about social issues and so forth. But when it comes to whether or not a man murdered his wife and an innocent bystander in the presence of his two young children and a neighbor looking out the window with bright lights on, I really don't give a damn what they think. They don't know what they're talking about, but they're more than willing to talk.
We know how O.J., despite your best efforts, may be remembered. How would F. Lee Bailey like to be remembered? What do you think is your legacy when you are discussed in 30, 40, 50 years' time?
You know, I think I'll suffer the same fate as O.J. There will be people who think, well, here was a charlatan. As Bill Buckley once said to me, here's a young man who makes money through crime. And that's fine. I was trained in the Marine Corps, where you learn safety is not important. The mission is important. And if you die in the process, that's too bad. I'm going to die, I hope no time soon, and history will be mixed, I think. But the people that count, the people that I would invite into my home, are going to say there was a great fighter who happened to be a lawyer.
Yeah, and there's no one who disagrees with the fact that you were a hell of a good lawyer. Very nice talking to you, and I appreciate the time you gave us.
All right. It's very nice talking to you. Good interview. And I'm glad you don't pull your punches that would have made for a dull chat.
Thank you very much for talking to us. F. Lee Bailey.